Blog Talk Radio.
Young patriot, I struggle for right, not for security alone do I fight, but the freedom to be whatever you might be. If we live in socialism and not slavery, I am a young patriot and I have a creed. I believe in others 'cause we have believed. Not in the rights of rulers, but humanity. To be healthy and happy and to be free. A young patriot, a term I define, not a matter of age, but a state of mind. And if you love freedom for liberty, you can join the young patriots and fight for it there. Yeah, join the young patriots and fight for it there. Join the young patriots and fight for it there.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the August edition of When the World is on Fire, the official podcast of the Young Patriots Organization. We got a really great show for you today. We got a new co-host, Mabruka Mubarak, who actually came on and was our guest and talked about international development in Tunisia. She's going to be our new co-host. She may not make it every single podcast, but she's going to try to make as many as she can. So, and I got her on the line right now. How you doing, Mabruka?
Hi, Zach. Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. So first we're going to go over what's all going on and stuff we need to talk about, the events and stuff that we need to talk about. The crazy thing is we moved into our house here in Montgomery and a tree actually fell on our house. So we're now living in a rental across the street. So it's been a really, really crazy month. Don't have any real big events going on. We actually did some interviews with a journalist from In These Times about the cooperative movement in Birmingham. So there should be a new article coming out pretty soon about the cooperative movement in Birmingham. And that's pretty much all we got going on right now. Trying to sort of get some stuff started here in Montgomery. If there's anybody who's from Montgomery that wants to join a Young Patriots organization chapter here in Montgomery, please let me know. Particularly if you're a veteran, we're interested in trying to organize some veterans. So just let us know. What do you got going on, Mabruka?
Well, you have to deal with a tree that fell on your house, and I have to deal with a move to Morocco very soon. And I hope to continue kind of the work that I was doing, but looking more into social movement in Tunisia and looking into specifically on the rise of the demand on dignity, and that's something we've talked about when we met in Birmingham twice this year, I think. So we can probably talk about that.
Cool. So one of the reasons that we talked about wanting to do this podcast together is because of the importance of what we've been calling transnational solidarity. And for me, transnational solidarity is maybe not is that we're doing exactly the same thing because there's different contexts, but maybe that the principles of the movement are at least similar across geographic territory. What's your thoughts on transnational solidarity?
Yeah. So for people who are listening to us, there are some people from Tunisia, from kind of all around the world. We met Zach and I. It was part of a trip that a friend of ours, Landria Williams, took me to understand better cooperatives and the commons in the United States. And I was very interested in that because of the rise of the cooperative work in the commons in Tunisia after the revolution. And we've noticed in Tunisia that one way that people were able to implement their demand of the revolution wasn't through the Constituent Assembly or through, but what really became reality was always when the effort was led collectively. There is a couple of experience for environmental justice, or also like people who reclaim land, for example, and they say we want dignity. So the idea was to understand better the commons in the United States and globally, because what we've seen after the Arab uprising is this constant demand for dignity that I think that whenever the politicians and global institutions, they're telling us you will have jobs and development and work and growth, the people continue claiming, no, we want dignity. And this demand, to me, what we've seen in Tunisia, at least in the Arab world, in the Arab uprising, is it was a way to kind of to push away that dominant narrative of neoliberal development and reclaiming what it means, dignity. So after we met, we brought Habib Ayed, the geographer from Tunisia, who did this movie called Couscous of Dignity. And the idea was what we talked about transnational solidarity. And I think that I'd like to just maybe just quote Habib Ayed when he talked about that. He said for him, solidarity is not, you know, you helping us or us helping you. It's actually sharing struggles. So when we share struggles, we don't have to have the same particularity, the same context. However, we can better understand these pattern of dominations that are creating structural inequality, racism, patriarchy, colonization, things like that. So that's kind of the whole point of the podcast, is we're going to talk about issues and see it from different perspectives and see if we can share common struggles.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, this idea of dignity and also how that connects to the commons. I think we had never put it into words before that we were sort of having a struggle for dignity at Birmingham and in Alabama. But I think that's what we were doing. We would talk about stuff like food sovereignty, which, and like, you know, controlling the businesses and so on and so forth. But really, when you look at what a lot of our struggles are about, it's about caring for other people who are oppressed and caring for each other and building that type of healthy type community and being able to build that type of healthy type community in a institutional situation that is not favorable to that. I think really that the idea of dignity and the idea of commons are deeply connected, because for me, commons, I don't know how you define commons, but for me, commons are sort of like, there's like the practical term for commons, which is like democratic self-management of communities. And then there's like a spiritual part of commons, which is more like we step off the cliff together. You know, we take this chance of living life together. And to me, that's how I think about commons. And I think that all ties into dignity.
Right. And commons can be also a way to look even in the future, even like talking, like, for example, for me, the way I approached it, it was, I was a member of the parliament after the revolution in Tunisia, tasked to draft the constitution. And so that exercise pushed me to understand, to actually project ourselves in the future, not project me or my party, but all of us as a people in the future, for writing texts for people who are not even born. So that idea, you transcend the individualism and the moment, the present moment, but at the same time, you draw a lot of inspiration from your past. So this idea also of commons. And I think that from that, you can draw a lot on, you know, dignity is a word also that is not easy to explain or to, there's not, if you look for a definition, you won't really find it, but this sustained demand goes, we see it hand in hand with this idea of collective consciousness, of collective work, and a rejection of neoliberal values of individualism, competition, and so on.
And I think for me, like, one of the things that's been on my mind right very clearly recently is that, you know, there's a lot, I mean, when you're working for this stuff, there's steps forward, but there's also steps backwards. And I feel like Birmingham has taken a few steps backwards because of electing a mayor who turned out not to be, you know, who we thought he was. And I wonder what you think about, like, you know, it's nice to talk about the high-minded ideals and everything, but could you talk about, you know, steps forward and steps backwards, and how, you know, we all need to support each other globally in order to continue this work even through difficult times.
Right. I mean, you know, people will always disappoint. They will always. I remember in Tunisia, I was advising Moussa Marzouki, who was the president during the transition, and a lot of people wrote so much about, you know, criticism, which he wasn't immune to that, of course. He wasn't perfect. But that's the thing. It's like we tend to have higher expectations from representative democracy, and especially presidential system, where we put so much power to the man who is going to represent us. And we are relinquishing our power and our possibility to do things. So, yes, the president of Tunisia after the revolution was not, he did not, you know, there were a lot of things I wish he'd done, of course. But at the same time, I'm not like creating this impossible image of the perfection, right? So he's not immune, because I do not believe that one person can change our life, right?
Sure.
It's really about the people, it's about the community. And in the same way, I think, like, for example, in the United States right now, a lot of people are starting to have the wake-up call, especially when President Trump ditched the Paris Agreement. And then a lot of people started thinking, oh, my God, but, like, we don't need him. We are going, as mayors, we're going to continue this environmental effort. So my point is, the mayor of Birmingham is, maybe he's disappointing, but any mayor would disappoint, because it really is not about him. It's about a movement. It's about people. And I think as long as people are here to stand up and to say, this is where this is not good, that's great. But again, like, all, you know, I don't really believe in representative democracy through election. I think there's a lot of flaws into it, a lot of expectation. We are giving way too much power in our local governments, whereas, you know, community, you know, councils or communities should have much more power to say, you know, we shouldn't go to the ballot and then give up, right? We should go to the ballot but then continue, you know. And that's I think very, very challenging. I'm not saying it's easy, but I think you all should continue standing up to what is going on in Birmingham. Certainly call them out and continue the fight.
Yeah, and I think you're right, and I think we should keep fighting for sure. But it's so funny, I've been listening to you talk about not liking representative democracy and thinking about ways to rethink democracy, and we're going to have a guest on in a couple of months who is an expert in this idea. But you start talking to people about in the representative democracy, and they're actually very like it. They like the idea. They're like, it couldn't be any worse. And so it's interesting that there's so much support for such an idea when it seems like it would be so radical. Anyway, we got a Carolyn Finney on the line. Carolyn, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
I'm good. You're on the air with me and Mabruka Mubarak, who is our new co-host. So I'm going to ask you a couple of questions, and then Mabruka is going to ask you a couple of questions.
Yeah,
that
hello.
Sounds great.
Such a pleasure. Such a pleasure to be in that podcast. Thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Okay, Carolyn, the first question is, you were on the National Park Service Advisory Board, and recently almost all of the people or all of the people on the advisory board resigned because Trump's Department of the Interior guy would not communicate with the National Parks Advisory Board. Could you talk a little bit about that advisory board, what it does, what its purpose is, and why y'all came to the decision that you came to?
Yes, I can do that. Okay, so a couple of things. So I served two terms, which was 8 years. And I will tell you that before I served on the National Parks Advisory Board, I didn't know anything about it, never actually thought about it, didn't really think about the national parks either. But the year before I started to serve on the board, the Park Service put together something called They put together a special committee for a year to decide, you know, are the parks going to retain their relevancy and what that means. And for that particular group of people they put together for a year, I was really privileged to be on, but I was really sort of at the low part of the totem pole because they had people on that panel like E.O. Wilson and Sylvia Earle, who does work on the oceans, and Sandra Day O'Connor, you know, was one of the Supreme Court judges. And a lot of people to get together over the course of the year and think about how the National Park Service will retain its relevancy. So at the time that finished, it was called the Second Century Commission. The then Secretary of Interior, with Secretary Salazar, met with some of us. He read what we had come up with in terms of what we thought the parks need to be focused on. We talked about education, science in the parks, the issue of diversity broadly defined, the impact, you know, the way to think about vision and how the Park Service needs to see itself differently. And then Secretary Salazar asked some of us, would we then serve on the National Parks Advisory Board? Now, the National Parks Advisory Board, and I might get this wrong, but I believe it's been around since like the 1940s. So it's been around a really long time. It's not always active, but it's been around. The primary job of the National Parks Advisory Board is actually to not validate, but affirm and confirm new national park historic sites. So all those monuments and historic sites that you see across the country that now have the national park assignation, it's because at some point some advisory board affirmed that. They, some historians, national park people, they go out, they make a case, they put together a story about a site and come in. So that's the primary job. But in this particular board that I served on, we were actually doing a lot. We were a very active board. Usually when you have a Democratic, if there's a Democratic president in the White House, you tend to get a board that is interested in social cultural issues around the Park Service. If you have a Republican president in the White House, there tends to be a focus on infrastructure. And actually, neither one of those things are problematic. The parks tend to be nonpartisan, right? But this particular White House is very different, as we've seen across the board, in terms of its behavior and how it shows up. So even the parks have come under fire. So a couple of things I want to say, that everybody who's serving two terms on the board, our terms would have been up last May. I mean, it would have been up a few months ago anyway. We knew that was coming. But what should have happened was once the Trump administration got voted in, and once Ryan Zinke, who's the new Secretary of Interior, got put into the Department of the Interior, what he should have done is met with all the advisory board members. Now, we were non-paid. We were citizens, you know, volunteering our time to do this kind of work. So Secretary Zinke should have met with us, heard what we have done, because not only, it's not about what the 12 of us did. all of us work with communities of people around the country who are also giving up their time, their knowledge, and their experience to focus on different issues from diversity, education, science, everything that I kind of laid out there earlier. He didn't respond to us at all. Like there was just no response to wanting to sit down with us to have that conversation. Our chair was one of the ex-governors of Alaska, and he really, I mean, he even wrote a personal letter to Zinke to say that he had also been a Navy SEAL. He tried to appeal, I would say, to his humanity and his own experience to say, I have a lot of things in common with you. Please sit down with us, because there are a lot of things that we'd like to share with you in terms of all the work we've done this last 8 years, in large part because we don't want that work to get lost. And he wouldn't meet with us. And so by the time, you know, last October, November, December rolled around, we were all pretty upset by that, because we gave him every opportunity to meet with us. We knew our term was going to be, most of our terms were going to end in 4 months. And we said, well, let's make this public. You know, maybe we can get some traction to open up the conversation, since they were being ignored. And that's when the op-ed was placed in the Washington Post. And then the following 2 weeks, I don't think I've ever spent that much time talking to the press. And I mean everybody from CNN down to, you know, a small local news outlet out west in Montana. I mean, it was a very intense 2 weeks, because how it got framed, the story of the National Park Advisory Board stepping down, you know, it got framed in the context of all the other people who've been stepping down and leaving the White House. Now, we weren't actually trying to do that, but it's the way that the press kind of framed it, which I don't have a problem with, but we kind of opened it up into a much larger conversation, so we got a lot of traction. Soon after that, a spokesperson for the Department of Interior made a public statement calling all of us quitters, which is what I find is fairly typical of this administration, to take the low road. And yeah. One of the things that was most offensive about that was that you're talking about, you know, quote unquote, we're citizens who gave and volunteered our time in terms of civic duty. We can use all that language. What they should have said was, thank you for your service. And then they could have just moved on, even if they didn't want to respond to any of the questions that we were raising. But that's not what they did. And so, yeah. And so I want to really make sure that I explain that it would have been natural for us to all have finished out our terms and be done, and that a new group of people would come in, a new group of advisors chosen by this administration. That's what should have happened. You know, it's just a sort of natural progression of things. But it's just the way that this, the Department of the Interior, Ryan Zinke, how they handled this. the understatement would be for me to say it was problematic, the way it was handled.
Yeah, do you think that... you know, were you trying to send a message when y'all stepped down, and do you think that it sent the message that you wanted to send?
Oh, I think we it was very intentional. I mean, we went back and forth, you know, on email with the letter, you know, all of us, you know, chiming in and editing, because we wanted to, there was a tone, too. We weren't trying to be, we weren't trying to take the low road, but we were trying to make a point. To say that we have made multiple efforts here, we've tried to reach out, and the more importantly, when we started hearing some of the things that were happening, we were hearing that, you know, many of the historic sites that we confirmed during my tenure were sites that, in particular, were telling stories of people we don't hear about, because we were all very, very much interested in diversity broadly defined. So, Stonewall. Or Sabra Chavez, and all of these parks and places and monuments and sites. I believe this fact is correct, but I would have to double check it, that under Obama's administration, it's the most diverse group of monuments and sites in the history of the Park Service that have gotten that National Parks assignation right at that time. And of course, one of the first things we hear from this administration is they want to roll all that back. Just like they want to roll pretty much everything else. They want to roll history backwards, right? So that, from, you know, Zinke saying that they want to increase the park fees. And, you know, look, between you and I and anybody listening, you know, it's not that I'm concerned very specifically about park fees. But what one of the cases we were making about are all the families and individuals who can't afford to benefit from the public land, right? And so we had worked hard to bring down those park fees or even eliminate them at places so it would open up the parks in terms of accessibility to all kinds of people, from all walks of life, so people can afford that. So these kinds of things were happening, and there was no conversation being had with us about it. You know, there was just no conversation being had. So,
yeah, I think y'all actually approved Birmingham as a national park site, the place where the Birmingham movement happened. I don't know if it was y'all, but it was under the Obama administration that the 4th Avenue Lynn Park area got approved as a national parks historic site.
Okay. Well, then
yeah.
Many of us, if it was under Obama, then yeah, it had to be because we're all, it had to be, I guess. Yeah, it had to be us.
So Carolyn, we've had a number of conversations about this over the years, and you recently have left academia and you didn't get tenure at Berkeley, which was kind of public and for dubious reasons. Can I get you to reflect on your time in academia, the positive and the negative of it, and also to sort of see how you view your work now that you're sort of independent and traveling around doing more dedicated public intellectual type work?
Yes, you can get me to reflect on it. It's a big one. I'm trying to think of even where to begin. The first thing that I would want people to know who don't know me is that, you know, I haven't been a person who's always been in academia. My first career, I was actually an actor. I spent many years, 11 years, pursuing that a long time ago in New York and L.A., and then there was a period of time where I saved my money and, I guess, in a form of self-education, spent time backpacking in other parts of the world, in Africa, in Asia as well. And it was during that time I decided to go back to school in my mid-30s to finish my undergraduate degree. And at that point, because I wanted to do some work, I was naively thinking about it, but I was thinking about how can I sort of be engaged with community? What will that look like for me? And I was very focused at first on gender issues and women in particular, and that has since expanded to think about race and think more broadly about other all kinds of different and inequality in general. I have never seen myself as an academic. I saw myself who worked in academia, and I know, Zach, you've heard me say that, and sometimes people laugh, and I don't mean that to try to be funny. In part, when I got the job at Berkeley, I saw how easy it would be for me to be subsumed by the institution. And it's not just about what I embody as a black woman, but also just in terms of my own ideas and ways of showing up and having these very challenging conversations around inequality and race and difference and power and identity and who belongs and who doesn't and whose knowledge counts. How was I going to be able to do that with any kind of integrity if I let myself be subsumed by the institution? Now, here's the thing for me. Institutions are made up of people, and I am really interested in all kinds of difference and my ability to meet people where they are. So I have no problem working with people in an institution. My problem comes when you think that by bringing me in, you think you're doing it under diversity and inclusion, and what you want from me is to assimilate. Because the thing I always tell people, if you want to engage people across difference, it has to be about reciprocity. Everybody has to do the work of learning and changing and adjusting to those differences, not the person who is all different that you're bringing in. So part of my frustration with academia is, in my experience, I don't want to say this for everybody, though I think there's studies and people out there who probably agree with me, and you've heard me say this too. So President Clinton came to Berkeley in about 2008, 2009, and I got a chance to see him speak in person. And I'm sitting way in the back in the balcony. He said a lot of things about a lot of things. And the thing that stuck with me is when he said, he goes, the problem he saw with developing the country was their infrastructure. They needed to really work on their infrastructure. He said, but the problem and the challenge for countries like the United States is the rigidity of our institutions. And it so resonated with me, and I didn't understand how much it resonated with me, because that was 2008, until much later when I started to go through some of the experiences I was having in there. The rigidity. Most of these institutions were never built with someone who looks like me in mind. It just wasn't. What, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, I could have never been standing there on that campus, not even as a student, let alone as a professor, right? And so what I can understand is that, you know, the rules, the way we evaluate, how we decide who's smart and who's not, how we decide which ideas we should prioritize and which ideas we don't prioritize, this has been set in place for a long time. And I know there's that sort of outward-looking, you know, the little bit we might see in terms of public media about, like, oh, everybody is so progressive there. Yes, you may have individuals, particularly students who come through or who are progressive, but the institution in itself is not progressive. It runs on money. It is very political. This is the part that's the challenging part, because I also think there's a good thing to say about it.
Can I jump in and just ask you a question on actually this particular topic? In your book, Black Faces, White Space, Reimagining the Relation of African American in the Great Outdoors, you quote Patricia Hill Collins in her book, Black Feminist Thought. You said there's no such thing as a scholar-activist dichotomy, and you a scholar-activist, and I met a lot of people who define themselves as scholar-activists. But then you also have organizer-activists that have trouble to work with scholars, and scholars kind of writing very complicated pieces, not really helping social movements. So we're not all scholar activists out there. Yeah. How do we, like, make these two populations work together? Because I've seen so many conflicts between these two, or scholars extracting knowledge from activists for the purpose of the publication and a number of quotes. And also an activist, not trusting scholars that really truly want to do improve the work. So what's your advice on that?
That's a great question. So I actually don't call myself a scholar activist. Other people call me that. So the first thing that I would say, most of us are not any one thing. The one thing that I would always say to people is that I'm also of a community. I'm not separate from the community. So even the way that I think of building relationships with those that I want to work with, learn from, and grow with, for me, it's just a completely different framing. One that academia and social science, I don't think, does that well. I think it's working at it. It has terms like participatory research. And there's ways within which people within the academy who really want to do it differently, who don't want to just appropriate, who don't just want to take that information, and so for their own gain in terms of how they get promoted, they want to do it differently. And here again is part of the challenge. The institution is still set up in the same old way, meaning that the primary reason I was told I didn't get tenure, because everything else in my packet, they were like, was outstanding. They told me two things. One, that I didn't have enough pages in the book. That's what it came down to. But before that was the way that I wrote the book to be accessible. So I was caught in a bind. I actually did not want to write an academic book that was going to be peer-reviewed, that only academics or someone in my discipline could read. I work with way too many people, and I live with people. I have an entire family who are not in or of academia. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in having a broader conversation and learning from that. So I had to walk this really fine line, because everybody was like, but if you do that, you're not going to get tenure. You're going to lose your job. So that's just real. And I discovered it the hard way, even though I held on. I could say that I held on to my own integrity. But this is what a lot of scholars are up against. The things that I am compassionate about and I empathize with, I don't like it, is that People don't want to lose their job. You know, they're scholars and they're doing all this work with ideas and they're privileged to do that work. Most of them have families. They got to pay the rent. They got to eat. You know, they got, you know, they got the same things as everybody else going on, and they don't want to lose their job. Now, I'm not saying they shouldn't risk it. What I ask people, I think we have to risk in order to gain, and that's the case I made. The reason I can't afford to not have my job right now. So I left my job, my full-time, well-paying job with health insurance. I'm talking to you at this moment. I have no health insurance. I'm making money. I'm trying to see, can I do the thing I want to do in a much more pure fashion without being complicit? Because if I'm in the institution, then I'm complicit in a very particular way, and it's a attention I don't know how to hold. I won't get promoted unless I do X, Y, and Z. But if I don't get promoted, I can't keep my job, right? So I think that there's something about the way individuals who call themselves scholars or who work within the academy can think differently about what is the relationship with the communities that you work with. What is your commitment to? You know, you can go in with your good intentions, but I'm less interested in your good intentions, and I'm more interested in how you attend to the impact of your good intentions. What are the consequences of your good intentions? A relationship goes beyond your research time in the field, right? It's more, if there's longevity to that. And that takes time, that takes attention, that takes clear intention. And it's going to build that tension for any new, particularly new scholar or young scholar who's coming up, because they're told not to do that. I mean, Zach, I don't have to tell you this, right? You're told not to do that.
So I would say I am definitely your student, for better or worse. The thing that I've always run into is that it's like, it's really kind of deep, and it's that if you actually care about the people you're working with, whether it be students or community members, you have no place in the institution. If you treat them like numbers and like ticks on a box ticks on a page, if you treat them like that, you have a place in the institution. But if you see a student who's struggling and you reach out to them and try to help them, you have no place in the institution. That's not your job. And it's dehumanizing. It's like profoundly dehumanizing. And that's why people who are going to college, like my students, are spending half their time in psychological services because they're stressed the fuck out because it's a completely dehumanizing situation. And I won't do it. Like, if I'm in the institution, I'm going to care for my students. And if they never hire me again, that's fine. But I also have, I mean, I'm also privileged because I have a wife with a good job who pays for my insurance. So, you know, like, I have that option. So I'm not shaming somebody who doesn't do that, but I do have that option to be able to operate in that manner.
Yes, and I want to say something, because you asked your initial question, to go back to what the first question was, what I heard you say was both what's good and bad about it. So I want to say something about what I say, what I think is good in terms of privilege, because I'm privileged to have 3 degrees. Nobody in my family does, right? And I would be a liar if I didn't say to you that hasn't opened up doors for me, because it absolutely has. Whether that's for good or bad, just like you said, it has opened up doors for me. It gives me some, when I walk in the room with my brown skin and everything else I walk in the room with, my unusual past, as people often say, because I didn't get here in a straight line, and I can say I have a PhD, I got to tell you, people kind of stood up a little bit. Whether that's, again, whether that really means anything or not, you know, specifically, we can have that conversation, but in terms of currency, cultural currency, social currency, and even political currency, it does mean something. I will say that my I understood after my time at Berkeley and now 3 years here at the University of Kentucky that I learned a lot about my own boundaries. I learned a lot about the places where I was complicit. I learned a lot about how, quote unquote, formal education is used and also how it is abused. I also, and I can't say this enough, because I know a lot of good people who work in these institutions. So I am really careful. I will demonize the institution. I got no problem doing that. But I will not demonize the people who work in the institution, most of them anyway, because I feel that there's some really good people who are students, who are staff, who are professors, who are trying to do something different. In part, I say that because part of the reason I didn't completely sink into a deep depression after the three-year fight over my tenure is because so many people, many who I didn't even know, reached out to help me from all around the country. And many of those people were in academia, who were finding ways to support me and still continue to do so because they know the story, have tried, you know, in their own way, to like put a hand out and say, what can we need? What would you like? Who? I think one of the reasons I get invited so many times to speak is in part because of that. I also think it's because of the work and the time. But I want to say that I think we have to be careful to remember in terms of our humanity. You know, I was telling somebody the other day, I was working with some students out in Seattle last week, and I said, you know, I will not, you know, somebody may treat me inhumanely, but I will not lose my own humanity and my ability to recognize and see somebody as human and treat them in the way that they deserve, no matter what it is they're doing to me. And it doesn't mean I have no fear of being angry, but I am not going to sink to that level just because someone else may treat me that way. And so I hold academia in this kind of strange place in my hand. I mean, I'm working with any number of institutions who, again, want to maybe figure out a way to hire me. And I'm saying to them, look, it's not that I don't want to work with you, but I do not want to be hired because I know what the thing is. You're going to put me into the slot. I said, if you're willing to actually take a risk and let's create a different kind of working relationship, I'm game. Because for me, it's all about creating something different, which means that everybody has to be willing to take a risk in order for that to happen.
Great.
And there's people with a significant amount of power and resources, and I think we can do it.
So we got about 17 minutes left, and we want to get to the book. So I'm going to turn it over to Mavruca to ask you some questions about the book.
Yes. I'm pacing in my living room, yes.
Oh, yeah. Okay, no worries. First of all, I wanted to say your book was is beautifully written. I just read it. Like, I wish a lot of people could write like you, where it you talk about complex concepts, but you make them really accessible. For me, the way your book has impacted me is I realize how much, so much, not learning that it provoked, but unlearning, actually.
Oh,
and what I mean
nice.
By that, but what I mean by that is there's all this, how you talk about how the dominant narrative and the perception shape relationship of your identity with the place. For me, it shook me because just to give you a quick story, my parents were immigrants, and they immigrated from North Africa to France. My dad worked at a GM factory in France, and we lived in a neighborhood in a project. A lot of immigrants from Africa, North Africa, and but in a rural setting, it was mountains. And my very good friend has her son, who is going to do a year in France. And she just called me to say, guess what? He's going to be like half an hour from where you grew up. I mean, that's like, oh, my gosh. Do you have recommendations for him? So he's American, is a young kid. He's 17, white, outdoorsy. So I, of course, look quickly, and I recommend that he check out amazing cave that you can go and visit. And then I paused a second, like, I have been advising this kid, this American kid, to do a lot of the things that I actually have never done myself.
And wow, like, right.
Yeah, how is that possible? And I'm like, why? I'm actually advising that he go climbing this mountain. I've never done it. Going to this kid, why am I doing this? And I paused a moment. And then reading your book, I realized that was not the question to ask. The question to ask was, what was the relationship of my people, my parents, my family with the environment?
Yeah.
And not believe, right, and not believe that to have a relationship with nature is that you have to climb or go to a cave, explore. So thank you for that, because this is like was like an important part where I paused and said, wait a second, So thank you. And now I just, can you tell us a little bit, like if you can summarize a little bit for the people who are listening, because I really want them to understand why it's so important to interview you on these issues of identity and place. Because to me, and this is kind of the reason why we're doing this podcast with Zach, is to share struggles. And I don't mean by that we all in the same context with them, but there's some interesting struggles that really is interesting to share here. So can you tell us a little bit about why you wrote the book and what it is about, quickly?
I can, and thank you so much for your generosity. It really, I mean, I feel like when somebody tells me that they liked the writing, it was successful, that they got something, that's like for me the greatest gift. So I so appreciate that. This book was really personal for me. So the reason, you know, I tell everyone really briefly that I grew up, I was born in Manhattan in New York City, and I was adopted by my family, African-American parents who were poor, black, moved up to New York from the South in the 50s. My dad looking for a job after he fought in the Korean War and had two job offers. One, he could be a janitor in Syracuse, New York, which is like 5 hours north of the city. On the other was 30 minutes outside of New York City. There was a very wealthy Jewish family called the Tishmans. Now, some older folks listening might know who the Tishmans are. They own so much real estate in New York City, Rockefeller Center. The Kushner Building used to be the Tishman Building in New York City. So to give you some idea, they had a 12-acre estate half an hour outside of the city, small pond, swimming pool, gardener's cottage, big house, trees, wildlife, beautiful. They needed full-time people on the property. My parents took that job. So my parents were the caretakers, the gardener. My father was the chauffeur. My mom was the sometime housekeeper. And they took care of that land for nearly 50 years. This was in a very wealthy white neighborhood. Harry Winston of Winston Jewelers had property down the street. There was a golf club around the corner. We were the only family of color. My parents moved there in the late 50s up until the 90s. We were the only family of color in that neighborhood. A Japanese-American woman moved in the 90s, moved out a few years after that. So you have the idea about the wealth. Around 2003, when I was now working on my PhD, and I was really getting interested in ideas of race and environment and who belongs and identity and issues having to do with land and place, it was really personal because Mr. Tishman had died years earlier, and Mrs. Tishman was very sick. So she'd been sick for a few years and knew that she was going to die. And the question is, what's going to happen to my parents? Now, the Tishmans didn't live on that property. They came up on weekends and holidays. But my family, we lived there full time. This is the land where I learned about myself, the land that I played on as a child, the land that my father worked all those years. What was going to happen to my parents? That land in the 1990s was worth over $3 million. The property taxes alone were $125,000 a year. The short of it is, my family wasn't going to be able to stay on that land, though I have to give Mrs. Tishman credit. She was trying to figure out if there might be a way they could do it. But she had grown children. There was a lot of there were a lot of issues. So they couldn't stay on the land. She had a house built for them in Leesburg, Virginia, because my youngest brother was living there. He was married with kids. I was moving around too much, as was my other brother. And my parents moved there in 2003. When this happened, what happened soon after that was my parents received a letter. And the letter was from one of their old neighbors in New York who said, you know, and the letter was about a page and a half long, and the letter said that a conservation easement had been placed on the land, on that property. And when a conservation easement is placed on a piece of land, it means that in perpetuity, nothing can be changed on the land. And it sent it around to everybody in that little community, let them know about all the conservation environmental values that that land held, all the wildlife and where it sat in the watershed, all these good reasons why an easement should be placed on this land. And at the very end of that letter, it wanted to thank the new owner, who at this point had been on the land for like 2 years, for his conservation-mindedness. And there was nothing in the letter thanking the people who cared for that land for 50 years. And that's why it became so personal, because I not only was thinking of my family, who became instantly invisible, their love of that land, of the blood and sweat they put into that land, all of it disappeared. It also meant that myself or no one in my family could ever go back home. We could never go back there. We last, about two, three weeks ago, we made a family trip. We drove from Virginia to New York, and we drove by that property. That property now has a big wrought iron gate across the driveway. Like, you can't get in there without permission, right? So it made me think about, in the history of this country, all the people who are invisible, who have always been there, who have worked the land, who have loved the land in their own way, who loved, you know, who have a sense of belonging. So whether we're talking historically about American Indians or any group of people, but largely, I would say, unfortunately, it's largely folks of color, right? Chinese, Japanese, Native American, Latinx. We have so many people in this country who've always been there in care. So I was motivated to write about that from a personal place and looking at African Americans, but what I was reaching for was something more broadly, to say that there are people here, whenever somebody says black people don't care about the environment or brown people don't care, you know, I won't curse on the air, but I get upset because I said, of course they do, and of course they have a relationship, and anyway, people need to eat, people breathe, people love, they fight on land, they live on it. Land tells us a lot about who we are, how we belong, how we show up. It literally gives us the ground upon which we stand. And the idea that someone else, unintentionally or intentionally, can make us invisible, they made my parents and my family invisible just like that. So what I wanted to do was talk to black people around the country and hear their stories, you know, because I knew that there were lots of amazing stories, because I believe everybody has an amazing story. And I wanted to hear, and I can't tell you how many black people said, nobody's ever asked me that before. No one's ever asked me about that before. That's how I was able to meet somebody like Mavine Betts, who came from a very wealthy black family in Florida, whose great-grandfather bought a piece of beach called American Beach, because in the 40s and 50s, if you were black in the South, you couldn't go to beach, but they had enough money, so they just bought a whole beach. And how she gave away all of her wealth to environmental causes, all of it. She was living on a chaise lounge on the beach for a while. I mean, she gave it all away. I talk about John Francis, who I met, a black man who spent 22 years walking across the U.S. and Latin America to raise environmental awareness, and he did it without talking for 22 years. Right? He just had his banjo. I sat in the trailer of one of the Tuskegee Airmen, you know, who used to be a farmer, you know. And so it was just, I could keep going. People who were activists.
And I love also that story about a lady that launched urban beekeeping, which was, nobody knew. It was started by this black woman. I mean, you know, in Vermont, there is Bill McGibbon, 350, and he's written about, you know, he has a book called Honey, and I read it, and, you know, and he, you know, there's a lot of beekeeping here in Vermont, and, but, like, this was started by a black woman. Nobody knows that. It's quite incredible.
Yes, and Brenda Palm Barber told me she had no idea. She wasn't thinking about being an environmentalist. She was thinking about how could she help this community of black folks, right, that you have previously incarcerated black men and women who come out of jail and nobody wants to give them a job. And people said in this community in Chicago said, can you help us think of something? So that's, and people thought she was crazy when she said beekeeping, you know. And, of course, it's turned into this huge business now for her in terms of for the community and making honey and honey-related products. But it's also local. It's very local. It's also about... Black people have a long history of beekeeping in the United States. So it's also got some deep cultural roots. And the thing that I love, and when I tell a story about her that I like to say is, you know, people talk a lot about outreach, and then people who know me and have heard me say, I hate the term outreach. Because what outreach means is that I reach out to you, I bring you to my table, and you have to learn everything about my table and how I work and how I speak. But I really don't have to do anything except make safety at the table. But I'm more interested in the relationship with reciprocity. And Brenda Palm's brother told me that when she interviews one of these young men or women for a potential job, the thing that she recognizes is that they don't come as an empty vessel. They're fully lived human beings who have a set of experiences and knowledges. And for her, it's about helping pull those out and helping them apply them to their work. So suddenly they have a stake in the community in a very different way. I saw one of these young men speak, and he had me in tears, me and probably everybody else in the room, because when he stood up in front of all of us and he seemed really uncomfortable, the first thing he said was, I never knew green could be so good to me. And he wasn't making a joke. like the idea of being green, you know, meant something entirely different.
You got about five minutes.
Yeah. Well, I could. I mean, there's a lot of things. Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. Just a quick question for people like me outside of the U.S. who we are following what's going on and, you know, the relationship with land. And, you know, there's a lot of, you've been talking about the black community, black people, black folks. But in your book, you choose the expression African-American. And so for us who are looking, what should we use when referring? Because I know that some people want to be called New African, some people want to be called Black, some people. But can you tell us for those who are outside the U.S.?
Yeah. So I chose African American in part because historically, you know, just I grew up in a family that identified as Negro, then Black, and so I was very particularly choosing that historical trajectory to sort of name who are the people that I was talking to, understanding that most of us are way more complicated and have got way more diverse histories. I believe that everybody should name themselves, actually. I would never presume to suggest what anybody should call themselves. The thing is, I think everybody needs to figure that out for themselves, how they want to show up. And I think it's more fluid than that. It's more fluid than that. If I had more time with you, because I just did, for my next book, I just did this whole DNA testing about my own genetic makeup because I was adopted, and a lot of things blew my mind that what I thought was true was not true, which then changes the way that I'm going to actually think about myself and how I show up. There was something else I wanted to say, but I kind of spaced it out there for a minute about belonging and there's one thing that I want to be sure and say. So now I wrote that book. It came out 4 years ago, and when I go around and talk, and this is the way that I evolved some of these ideas of looking at history and place and land and identity and belonging is evolving. And one of the things that's true to me that I didn't do in the book, but I try to do now when I tell the story about the land I grew up on, is that all this land in this country was stolen. All of it was stolen. And no matter how far away we get from that moment when all that land was stolen from the first peoples here, it's never going to change that one truth. And so I'm really interested in if me and mine are going to have our freedom, if me and my black family and my black community, you know, is going to have freedom, at what cost for anybody else? So what does that mean for American Indians? And I have no answer to that. But now I know I have to hold myself accountable when I even have this conversation to remember that land never belonged to the Tishmans, it never belonged to my family, because there were other people who were living there way before who we've since forgotten, but I think we need to remember that.
Right, and we don't have much time to talk about that, but just I wanted to say that a lot of the movement around land and is also, there is like a echoes with a struggle in Palestine. And like similarly, there is an incredible sophisticated movement for food sovereignty by peasant movement in Palestine, but like nobody sees it. And their knowledge is not being, their technology is not being acknowledged. And even the use of the land, Gaza, is rendered as a prison, actually, where people can't move. And so we don't have the time, but like what, like if you're writing in your next book on, you know, how land is stolen, what can you tell us about this, like globalized solidarity about how important it is?
Yeah. So
you got about 50 seconds.
I know that's actually not what I'm going to write on. I'm looking at the issue of black imagination and identity and belonging and how we decide what we call ourselves. But I will say that somebody from Palestine had said to me, why don't I go over there and learn about those stories, which I would love to do, because I think that's the most I can say is how we get a broader understanding of how these issues play out. And the specifics of those issues may be different, but I think broadly there's some similar stuff going on in terms of stolen land, who gets the claim they belong, and what land means to people, what place means.
Thank you.
Maybe in another.
You're welcome.
Thanks.
Thank both of you.
Thanks for having me. That was like great.
Yeah, it was fun. And we'll see y'all next month.
Yep. Okay. Thanks.